Hello, welcome to episode 7 of Launch and Learn.
Oh man,
don't think that suits me well. But yeah, welcome guys. Welcome to Launch and Learn, a podcast where myself, Matthias Dickerhoff, and my co-host, Alexander Thompson, interview founders from around the world to learn from their experiences. Today we have Vardika Manasvi on as a guest. She's the co-founder and CEO of Stackraft, a company looking to change hiring as we know it. She's going to talk about her experience starting companies in India, moving to Canada, having focus in your startup, and what the future of hiring will look like. Stay tuned. It'll be a great episode. Yeah, thanks, Vardika, for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, first question, what are you going to have for breakfast today?
Well, you know, I live all by myself, and I have to figure out what I need to cook. So my breakfast is usually simple egg and omelet and two pieces of bread, and I'm not bored of it.
Sounds pretty good. I wouldn't mind that every day. Yeah. To get started with, let's just start with your journey growing up in India. What's kind of your how you got started in working in the business world there?
Yeah, so I was always doing, I had a lot of side hustles. So I was always doing multiple things on the side. Like, as a 19-year-old, I got my first job, that of writing resumes. And I picked up the skill of writing resumes. And I was like, wow, this is quite interesting. And I can do a lot of it over the internet. So I just made like a little note on a piece of paper and put it on my apartment building to get people know about it, that, hey, I can help you with your resume writing stuff. So I had a lot of freelance type side hustles, and I was not even sure of the meaning of this word entrepreneur. But today when I think of it, you know, I feel that I always had that thing in me to do stuff on my own. When my first company really happened, that early instinct was when I was servicing clients and telecom operators. I always felt the load of, you know, taking permission before you take the risk of doing something, and always working within boundaries. So that was something that hit me hard. And I was like, why can I not move out of this whole situation and build something of my own and have a real company, have a real product? Mm-hmm. So those were the real early moments that built a lot of courage in me to take the decisions and, you know, own up my own destiny and life.
Cool. And talking about your first company, so what was your first company actually that you started? And also what were sort of the big learnings that you made from it?
Yeah, so my first company was called iMeU, Instant Meet You Connect. That was a location-based social network. So you can connect with people around you, strangers, in a hyper-local environment. Say you go to a coffee shop and you can see who others are in a coffee shop and, you know, meet interesting people around you. And what I figured was that is not what people want. There is lack of trust between strangers. And I figured a lot of meaning in what relationships matter and what people are seeking. My biggest learning with my first company was, you know, I was trying to be everything to everyone with that product and trying to do multiple things, solve multiple problems at one shot, like build the Facebook or the Google of the world on day one. And I think that was a very naive thinking on my part. And the failure of iMeU and the biggest learning that I got from it was to have a lot of focus and do things for a small set of people before even thinking about scalability, and do things in a, getting to the core of the problem, basically, you know, and not just have a patchwork like, hey, this is a new cool feature. This is what you can do. So, yeah, that is what I learned from my first company, first startup.
And how did that startup actually begin? How did you get involved with that?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I used to work with M Carbon, and This was back in 2013, and I was working with the biggest operator in India, Airtel, a telecom operator. And you know, I used to work with a team of engineers and developers. I was a marketer, and product management happened to me because I was like, marketing is just, you know, manipulating with communication. So I lost interest, and that's how I got into product. And when I was working with engineers and, you know, a bunch of software team, this whole idea, I started to read more because then I'm handling a team of technical people, and I had to give them clarity on what they're supposed to do. So I used to read a lot how to do product management in the right way, because I was also learning, right? And, you know, so the company started actually inside another company and had this whole idea. And I was like, I had no clue how a real company really works from the very basics, incorporation, having your own team. Like, I didn't even have a co-founder. The one thing that I was very sure was I need a technical person with proper skin in the game before I can have full courage to start that. So I had that idea early on, and I decided to join NASSCOM 10,000 Startups, which is like a, you know, not-for-profit accelerator. I was like, I need to learn how startups work. I need to work with a lot of other founders to be able to build this whole courage of, you know, going all in and starting my own thing. So I had this idea, and I started to work early on with two young developers and build the product and take basic steps. But yeah, I didn't leave my job at that time. I was working inside another company. And of course, everyone knew. I was very clear about it. Look, I want to do this one fine day, but I don't know how to do it, and I'm figuring out stuff. So I still need a job, because who will pay my bills? So I was always working in, you know, my first company happened inside other organizations.
So then how did you decide to leave, or when did you decide to leave and do it full time?
The product was shaping up, and, you know, I had more clarity of thoughts on how that can be monetized. And I just wanted to go all in and focus. And, you know, one fine day, I just pulled the plug. I was like, okay, you know, I questioned myself that why I joined this organization. I joined because I wanted to learn how startups work. And now, since I have an idea, why I'm not able to leave this job just because of having a cushion of a monthly paycheck. So I was like, okay, I just need to take this hard call and move on and, you know, give this one shot to myself and see if I can make it happen or not. So that's how I did. And I was, you know, I also went on the verge of running out of money and everything, and, you know, almost dying, moving cities. Like, I used to live in Delhi in India, and I was like, okay, this city is not working for me. I'm going to Bangalore. Everything happens in Bangalore. So, you know, and that's how NVIDIA happened to me. You know, I met the managing director of NVIDIA. I was like, look, I have this company, but I'm out of money. I have no money to survive, sustain. And what you need is I can do. And if you're okay that I keep running my business and you're still okay to hire me and you don't find me mad, that will help me. And he said, okay, you are mad, but I will still hire you. So then my company, I was working inside NVIDIA. I had a fancy office, food to eat, now got a final paycheck as well. And I was still working, you know, I was multitasking between the two things.
And how did you manage that? Like multitasking as well as, was your team still in, did they come with you as well, the team, or did they stay back, you know?
One of the engineers, so when we started, the team was entirely remote. And, you know, I was very focused on the outcomes and the work that you got to do. But when I moved to Bangalore, I was like, okay, maybe it's the team. That's why I'm not able to have good progress. And I need to have the team at one place. And I got one of my engineers that, you know what, we got to sit together. We got to live every minute of this together. And that's how we'll have progress. I did that, but it didn't work out. And finally, I decided, okay, we are moving on. And, you know, I figured a way to exit. And you know, moved on to a different product because we just had a lot of data and insights on why this product will not work. I reached at a dead end where I can clearly see that this product will not work. And then we pivoted. We moved to a different product called BFF, Best Friends Forever. And I was still inside NVIDIA doing that. And, you know, with the same set of engineers, we built that product. And I had more clarity on the market, the user needs. And that was a time when I said, okay, I need to leave India now. And I just saved a little bunch of money. In April 2018, I took a flight to Toronto.
And what caused you to make that decision to leave India?
You know, I was like, I'm trying to make things work and doing so many things. And it's the market that always wins. It's the user's needs. And I came to the realization that the Indian problems are very different. Indian users are highly price sensitive, and they are not early adopters because they're so busy in their own daily lifestyle and in their own struggles. They'll probably adopt a product because, okay, you get some free offers or coupons, or you save a hell lot of money or whatever. So it's, India is all about efficiency, productivity. That's the mindset of people. You know, they don't care about cool stuff. And I was building cool stuff. So and that led me to decide, okay, maybe I need to give this a shot in a different market altogether. Maybe the market is not right. And I just wanted to give myself one more chance and not come to, you know, believing that, okay, I don't have it in me. And that's how Toronto happened. And of course, I had the chance to be in Silicon Valley as well. But then I decided Canada over US, considering a lot of factors, noise and whatnot. And I was like, okay, let's just go Canada and see what's going on.
So you come to Toronto to start a new company. Did you already have an idea in mind, or before you came?
We had like a full-blown prototype, everything done. And so this was BFF. We launched it on Product Hunt as well, and got some really early good insights. So it was now a phone book based social network. So you can ask a question and your friends can recommend a contact for you to get in touch. So like a Quora for contacts kind of a thing. So I had this idea, and of course I was part of Founders Institute, the accelerator there in Toronto. And yeah, I mean, the whole idea was to have a product, an MVP, and test it, validate it. So I was literally asking people, why would you use it? I wanted to go core to the core of the problem because I've done that earlier. I've failed it. And now I clearly know how to get the initial set of users. I clearly want to prove that it's worth it for 100 users, you know, and then 1,000 users. So taking a very unscalable kind of an approach and validate the product at every single step. Yeah, that was my initial journey. So we had the product and everything. I was better off than a lot of wannabe founders. but then, it's a journey of its own.
How do you do the discovery process? So you said you do certain validations. Like, do you do, like, let's say, a prototype? Do you do customer interviews? And what can you sort of share some more tips and tools how you did that?
So from my last product, we had some insights and learnings on why we failed on the first product and what we are missing completely. It's not a utility for one user. It's not giving any value to one user. And for a network to work, you need to wait for a critical mass, and that doesn't happen initially. So that is one insight that we figured. The second was the trust issue. And third was instant gratification, like how users can get instant value the minute they are on the app. So these were some of the insights that we got from the last product. Now, coming to the discovery and the validation process, we just, you know, did a Product Hunt launch and got an initial set of users and then tracked their activity, their behavior, their patterns, and then interviewed them. So like a reverse process, first we identified who relates with this kind of a use case? And then we got deeper into the process and asked them questions. And, you know, not just like a survey kind of a thing, and, you know, send them a form and ask them some random questions. I don't think that really works. But doing more of interviews and going specific that, would you use this? Would you remember using this, say, even after 15 days or 20 days? Does it help you? Does it have a utility? So, you know, go really the basics of a question and see if this product has a place in the daily life of a user.
And what was the adoption like of the product? Did you see kind of the growth rates that you were anticipating?
Not really. And what I discovered actually with BFF was that I made the same mistake that I made in my first company, which was taking a very horizontal approach and not looking at just one vertical. So when I say horizontal, means you can ask for a doctor, you can ask for a plumber, you can ask for a teacher, you can ask for a software engineer. And this is what we did with iMeo as well. So while we solved some of the other issues of trust and blah, 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 utility, but the problem was, okay, we're trying to be everything to everyone and not something to someone. So we discovered some of the patterns that when I was in Toronto, the basic question that was coming on the app is, I'm looking for a job, or can you recommend an engineer? And Toronto is a very diverse city. A lot of new immigrants come over to the city like on a daily basis. So when I was doing these interviews, I used to meet people who are new in the city trying to find a job. So, and that got me thinking. I was like, wow, this job thing is still a problem, yeah? And the resume stuff, which I messed up like 10 years back, it still doesn't work. And then I wanted to figure out, of course, I had limited time. I was running out of cash all over again. And then I had to figure that, okay, who will pay me for this? And what is a monetization model? And this time around, I started working reverse. I was like, okay, let me work from the back. And so I just had a simple idea on a 2 presentation. And we have this product, which is live on App Store, which of course, a buyer doesn't care to even look at until you tell them what is the problem. So it's like, okay, I have this simple deck and I will try to sell it first because I am running out of money all over again. I have to go back to India now. So I had to like literally figure a way to find a buyer and who will pay me for the value that they can get from this app. And that's how BFF became StackCraft, which is today. And I found a first customer on the streets of Waterloo queuing up for an event. And he said, okay, this is interesting. We'll pay you $5,000. I'm like, okay. The next day I incorporated the company in the US. So yeah, it was quite a wild ride.
Did a lot of the same team join you from BFF, or did you kind of go on your own?
So yeah, my co-founder was always there. I mean, I met my co-founder over Twitter, when I was even working on my first product, because like I said, I was looking for a CTO, a co-founder always. And so he was always there. And then of course he was part of StackCraft and we built this together. And now he also had a lot of experience and, a lot of skin in the game. So an equal say and everything. So my relationship with my co-founder also grew over the past 5 years of hustle and figuring out stuff, various experiments. And like when we started working, me and my co-founder, we never even met each other in real life, but now I have so much of trust in him. It's a phenomenal partnership that we have. So like some days I really talk to myself and I think, what would I have done if Cilento was not there?
So you mentioned before how you think that the recruitment system is currently broken, and you've written a lot about it as well. Mm-hmm. What do you think exactly is broken, and how did you build StackCraft to solve the gap there?
So, well, everything on recruitment is broken. I'm very bullish on those things. Every thing that's going on in recruitment is nonsense. And it's such a huge market in itself that any company can come up and, you know, have three or four clients and do a little patchwork and solve that little problem. It's broken to that extent from sourcing, selection, shortlisting, your interview process, offer acceptance, retention, employee culture, resource optimization, exit, everything is broken. And it's also because people are hard, right? I mean, human science is the hardest science of all. And how we are trying to, not trying to, how we are fixing is by weighing the data, by taking a data-driven route and a lot of focus on analytics. And, you know, have first principles thinking and ask a lot of why, and, you know, go down to measuring everything, which is helpful to take predictive decisions. So we are not challenging human judgment here, but we are using predictive data by, you know, understanding a person's problem-solving ability, their previous work patterns, what projects they've done previously, their core skills, and have a human in the loop to do that evaluation in an unbiased, blinded way, and use that all that data to matchmake with the company. So, you know, in short, we are trying to challenge the keyword style of working. You know, you just put in a bunch of keywords and have a list on LinkedIn and then go spam them. So this is how it's working, right? Just can't reach out to people just like that. This is what recruiters are doing, and that's what causing the whole noise in the market. So it has to be a lot of precision, a lot of matchmaking involved in terms of what people want. So we identify that if we are able to respect privacy for a user and not, so when I say respect privacy, which means that if they are trusting us with their data and, you know, creating profiles over StackCraft and giving us access to their digital footprints, previous work, blah, 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 then we should not sell that information to that company. We should respect that data. So that was the first thing. Second was, we have to be mindful of their attention. Like if someone is really happy in their own work and they have preferred not to be contacted, we don't even send them any emails, you know? So we are not fans of daily active user on the app. Like we are not built our app StackCraft right now. We don't care that, hey, you need to come on this app daily, at least once a month, or you're a churn user. No, you trust us with your data and you trust us that we'll make a good recommendation and match. And we are like a community. You can come to us when you need something, or when you want to contribute and do peer evaluation and help other software engineers land jobs, is when you have to come. Like, so we do not, daily active users and, you know, monthly active users is not at all a metric that we track.
Yeah, I guess it's good to just get an overview of the whole product journey. Like if I say I'm a recruiter looking for some new engineers and I want to use StackCraft as a solution, what wouldn't that journey be like for me to find a candidate?
Well, it's very simple. You know, you sign up in under a minute, you post your job. And when you're posting a job, you get the option to either use our question bank and challenge bank, which will be connected to your jobs as per the skills, or you have the ability to create your own challenge. If you're very specific to the job, mostly hiring managers do that. And once the job is posted, the very next minute, you get recommendations from the pre-existing qualified talent pool that we match to your jobs. And second, you start also receiving new applications. And the new applications you receive over a period of time, that job gets distributed in the developer communities. So we auto-post a job based on the skill in, you know, developer channels, like in Slack communities, Discord groups, and various dark social net channels to get you more applications. So that's one. And second is you get candidates recommended right on front, and you can send them an interview request, view their data, their profiles, and decide if you want to invite them to apply to your job. So you can invite those people who are active to apply to your job. So it's as simple as that.
I mean, how do you see the future of you know, job search, especially around artificial intelligence? I mean, things might be changing as well with that coming into the market.
So yeah, I mean, with job search specifically, a lot of people I see are applying AI again to slice and dice the current data, just the whole keywords thing, right? Like how you have written a sentence in your resume says how you think, and apply some natural NLP stuff, and all of that is crap. I mean, I'm sorry, but talking about software engineers, they are good at writing codes and not resumes, and resumes are usually a work of copy paste. That is what I did, and that is what everyone does. So and even on your LinkedIn profile, it's hard to understand a person and their work without going into the depth and the nuance of that work, just by looking at the keywords and, you know, slicing and dicing and applying some kind of an NLP on top of it, or video analytics or video resume. A lot of people are doing a lot of things, and you know, or have a huge coding test done on a specific language. I would say that data alone is not helpful. It's a very deep problem, and it is specific to every job. Like I have a lot of views and opinions on even the job boards. They are just aggregating links, and companies are putting out jobs out there which doesn't even say exist. The job is closed, or they're not hiring, but hey, they have a fancy link out there. So a lot of noise is there, specifically in this case, and it's very sad to see. Like, there are people who are looking for jobs and say, you know, for a job that gets advertised over the internet on any famous site, at least they receive 200 to 50 applications. Now, not all of them even hear back. Like, they don't even get a feedback. So what is missing on the job seeker side is you don't get feedback, even if you're rejected. Why you're rejected? At least, okay, you cannot give me a job. That's fine. Tell me so that I can improve. That's number one. Second is, you know, having transparency of the process, that what is happening with my application and who am I competing with, and what is the next step to expect? Like, a job seeker has a lot of questions. Okay, are you flexible with the timings? Do you want me to relocate? Will you sponsor visa? Most of those details, like even a job description, is not objectified and articulative enough for a job seeker to take decision. And what they end up doing is, let me just apply to everything that's out there and I'll figure when they call me. So that's the user behavior and pattern that emerges up for that reason, because job descriptions are a work of copy pasting as well. And the third big thing is, you know, that initially when you apply to a job, right now, everywhere, almost everywhere on the internet, you apply by sending your cover letter or your resume, which fails the purpose, because nobody has the time to go through all of that. So that application process has to be made simple enough and unbiased, so that you're evaluated on your skills. So how it works on StackCraft is, when you apply to a job, you play a specific challenge. You answer like a 15-minute question, which evaluates on your ability to solve a problem. And it's specific to a job as well. And you're being ranked on the simplicity of your thinking, the depth, modularity of your thinking, and performance. How much time did it take you to answer that? And all of this is done by an expert. So when an expert is ranking you, they look at the quality of your answer. They don't even know you're a male, female, which part of the world you're coming from. They rank you on that answer. And after that ranking, they see the full profile and then give you a review comment on that. So this is how StackCraft is doing, fundamentally different than anyone else in the market.
Back to the business itself, when you moved to Toronto, you joined some accelerator and government-run programs for businesses. Mm-hmm. What was your experience going through some of those, like throughout the pivot? What was their support like, and how did they, what did you learn from that?
So yeah, I've been a part of a lot of accelerators and incubators on both sides of the table as an entrepreneur and someone helping entrepreneurs as well back in India. And my biggest learning, like the first thing is the reason why I always, you know, joined an accelerator was not that I'm looking for mentorship or some concepts and, you know, help with my business and I'm not able to take decisions, but because I need a network. I've always moved to different cities. Like right now I'm in Calgary and, you know, I was part of Platform Calgary. And I've always moved to different cities because I need a head start. I need a network. I need a bunch of people in my peer group so that, you know, they can empathize with my journey and my challenges. And, you know, I also have, I find new friends and, you know, and they're all founders and entrepreneurs. So that is the biggest thing that I look for any accelerator. It is the, you know, the similar people that you end up meeting and finding who have a similar thought process and probably same challenges. So your conversations are very similar. Hey, did you engage a lawyer for this? How do you do that? Do you have a contract for this? You know, and these kind of conversations you cannot have in your life otherwise. So I think that's the biggest thing that any accelerator has given me. A lot of great friends around the world. And yeah, so this has been my biggest takeaway from any accelerator.
Do you recommend to always go for accelerators as a startup? Or are there some situations when you're like, no, I should not do it?
No, I don't recommend going for accelerators. So here's what I recommend. I recommend having a lot of, you know, being very intentful with any decision. As a founder, you're always out of time. Your day is over, but the work is not over. And you're flipping between multiple decisions, multiple work. So joining an accelerator is also a lot of commitment because you have to commit to their schedules, their programming. You have to be respectful for what they're doing. Even if it doesn't fit on your business, you still have to do it. And I feel that just getting advices from people who have not been in a similar boat as you are and who do not relate to the core of the problem as you do, those advices can be harmful sometimes and can just, you know, result in you taking a wrong decision. And it takes a lot of conscious effort to know, and failures, a lot of conscious effort, your own previous learnings, to really know what is a good advice and what is a bad advice. And sometimes as young entrepreneurs, young founders, we get influenced by people around us and their experience, right? So I think for that reason, I think having a lot of intent in and focus in doing what you're doing and why you're doing it helps you move in the right direction. And having a clear outcome, that what you expect out of that accelerator, having a clear outcome, like I have a very clear outcome from an accelerator. I want great relationships. I want great people on the back of my phone who I can just text right away and ask a very, very basic question that Google doesn't tell me the answer to, right? So that's what I expect out of an accelerator, if not money.
So looking ahead with StarCraft, you know, what is your plan there? Do you have a sort of a product vision, expansion plans that you also could share with us?
Yeah, I do have a vision, which is that of equality in hiring. And so I think I feel that when we work with people, we take a very binary approach and we look at, you know, we look at signals that we can trust, like the kind of companies that you work with, what you've done previously, which school did you go to, what city were you born, how do you look like? That kind of a binary approach gives signals to a human mind to trust someone. Now, I feel that there's a lot of people around the world who probably come from different backgrounds and who don't look like you, and they're born in a wrong country, which is not their fault, and they didn't go to school because they had internet to learn from, and what they don't have is those binary signals to be given the opportunity, right? So with StackRaft, my vision is to equalize that to a certain extent, to have enough data and signals that a human mind can value more than what you see on paper. It's hard. It's very hard.
And you talked, well, you mentioned before about also how when you build a network, you kind of need this critical mass before it's effective.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you've reached that with StackRaft, or what's the next steps? Like, how do you get to that point where you hit that critical mass?
Yeah, I mean, we haven't reached that step. So with StackRaft right now, our focus is, emerging tech, deep tech companies. And we are really focusing on the early adoption. Like, yeah, there are a lot of job seekers out there who we can help, and a lot of jobs, and do this matchmaking and all of that. But we are taking a very focused approach, which is working with verified and curated opportunities, which is full-time, permanent. Say they allow you remote work, or they're sponsoring your visa, and that opens up like a borderless kind of an opportunity. And they, and we like curate them in a very human way, verify them that this position really exists, and the company has the intent to close this position, and they really care about diversity, and you know, going all in for the right person. And then on the job seeker side, we also value their time and attention and their data to come and create profiles on our platform. And we don't just spam them with a lot of emails, hey, we got new jobs, come apply. We don't do all of that. We take a very precision-based kind of an approach. And a lot of matchmaking is done by machine and a lot by hand as well, just because we care a lot about the accuracy of that information. So we have a very niche focus, deep tech companies and, highly skilled tech talent in the emerging fields, because that is tough to find in your own neighborhood. And that is where companies open up and say that, okay, we can hire from anywhere in the world. Like recently, we got an engineer from Spain hired with a cannabis startup in Silicon Valley. And earlier there was a engineer from Australia who got hired with a blockchain company. So this cross-border connection is so beautiful in its own way. So with StackRaft, we haven't reached that at that stage. And the plan is to get that, early network effects and early utility for this handful of people who are using the product. And there's pure unit economics. So I'm not losing money on the table. And then based on that, we move on and, build that expert network and use our experts to help us with distribution. And everything that we have built so far, we have not spent money on ads. The network has been sort of self-driven, organic, and very community-oriented, word of mouth.
What are some key learnings you wish you would have known when you started, maybe even StackRaft or even before then, when you start these companies? What are some things you would have told yourself back then?
So I teach that to myself even today, which is, trying to be very, very specific and have a lot of focus and intent in doing whatever I'm doing. And a lot of focus helps to keep moving forward and measure the progress. As entrepreneurs, you end up doing multiple things and juggle between a lot of multiple tasks. It causes a lot of mental imbalance and that whole your own ability to take good decisions. So that's one. The second thing is, you know, you're not your work. You have to learn to sort of let go. So when things don't work out, you have to sort of let go and not own up that thing, because you're bigger than your work. You're not your work. So that's the second big thing that I wish I had inculcated initially in my journey. And I still teach myself, like, literally daily. I try to tell myself, you know, there are better things to do. And if it works, it works. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work.
Yeah, because you're involved in your startup like all day.
Yeah.
You become so part of your identity that it's hard to separate that, right?
Yeah, that's true.
Where can our listeners connect with you online?
Twitter. Like, I'm super active on Twitter. I respond to almost all tweets, except for a few. So yeah, Twitter, I'm on V Manasvi. My V, people call me V, and my last name. So yeah, just look for V.
That's very simple.
See, that's the point.
Great. Yeah, thank you so much.
So thank you so much again. It was a great conversation, and I look forward to being in touch with both of you.
Thank you very much for listening. We really hope you enjoyed it. Our captivating theme song is The Vendetta by Stefan Kartenberg. If you want to connect with us or send a guest recommendation, drop us a line at launch.learn@gmail.com or connect with Matthias or myself on LinkedIn. Have a great one, and see you next time on Launch and Learn.